Thank you. Wow, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. I want to thank the selection committee for selecting me. That's quite an honor. Also, looking at the list of previous speakers, it's quite a group to be on the same list with, and I hope I can do it justice. And I also want to thank Ed for his hospitality as well. And thank you for the California weather in Toronto. We're not having California weather right now in California. It's raining, I'm told. Today, I'm going to the title, as you saw, was Statistical Learning with Large Numbers of Predictor Variables. And the problem I'm going to be addressing, if I can find the page up, no? How about page down? That doesn't work either. How about that? All right, I give up. How do I advance the page? Oh, those guys. All right. Thank you. Okay, and here's the problem that I'm going to be addressing, and it's a problem that has fascinated me for a very long time, perhaps too long. It's the statistical prediction problem. We in statistics either call it regression or classification. And what one has is a system under study, and associated with that system are attributes that have values. We call them usually variables. And these attributes or variables have values that can either be measured or observed. One of the attributes is special. We usually label that with the symbol Y. We call that the outcome or response attribute or a variable. And it's special because its value is unknown. But we would like to know it because it can help us make a decision, which may be make us some money or something else. So we don't know its value, but we would like to. What we do know are the joint values of other attributes or variables associated with the system. We usually call those the predictor variables, and we give them the label X. And the goal of the exercise is to use the known joint values of the predictor variables to estimate or predict a value for the outcome or response variable. And that's the problem. So our prediction, say y hat, for the actual outcome variable y is some function of the predictor variables. And it's the argument, of course, is usually multidimensional, not always, but usually. And of course, the purpose of the exercise is that we would like to get a good predicting function. Now, of course, there'll be a different good predicting function for each problem. And for each problem, we'd like to find a good one. Now, today, I'm going to concentrate on linear models. Tomorrow, I'll be talking about nonlinear models, models that are nonlinear in the predictor variables, sort of general purpose nonlinear models. But today, it's linear models for two reasons. One is that they're, of course, of interest in themselves. They're highly applicable to a wide range of problems. And secondly, linear models often, not always, but often form the basis for the more general nonlinear models. Okay? Now, as you all know, a linear model, that is linear in the predictor variables, is characterized by an intercept and a slope parameter or coefficient for each of the predictor variables. And of course, what we want is a good linear model. We want to choose a good linear function, which means we want to choose good values for the intercept and the slope or coefficients parameters. Okay? Now, in order to do that, we have to define what it is we mean by good. What do we mean by a good linear model? Well, loosely, we mean it's accurate. Well, what does accurate mean? We have to define it. Okay? And this is how it's usually defined. One defines a cost or loss function which gives you the cost for mistakes or errors. This is a function of two arguments. The first argument is the true value, true unknown value, but we presume there is a true value, we just don't know what it is, and the value that's predicted by our function. And this is the loss or cost when the true value is y and we predict a value f. The idea is we want to know why because we want the value of why because we want to make a decision. Okay, now that decision will have consequences, either good or bad. We'll either make money or lose money. We'll either get the right diagnosis or not the right diagnosis or whatever. Okay, our presumption is that if we knew the true value of why, we would make the best decision given the other information that no doubt goes into this decision as well. But we don't know the true value. We have this predicted or estimated value, and that may cause us not to make the best decision. And when we don't make the best decision, we'll lose something, and this is how much we lose, and it's specified by this function. This loss function is generally different for each problem, and we have to somehow specify it. The problem is that, first of all, how much you lose when you don't get exactly the right answer. Quite often it's hard to encapsulate it in formula. Sometimes it's easy, but usually it's not. And secondly, if we could, we'd have to write different software for every problem to try and get an accurate answer based on that loss function. So that causes us to use generic loss functions that we hope will serve sort of as a surrogate for whatever our loss might be. And here are some surrogates. When y is numeric, a natural loss function might be the size of the error, the absolute difference between the actual value and what we predict. In statistics, we tend not to use that one, but it's square. And the reason for that is not because it's necessarily a better surrogate. I have never seen a problem. I've seen problems where the loss was this. I've never seen a problem where the loss was this. The reason why people like squared error loss is because it's by far the most tractable, both in terms of learning algorithms and in terms of statistical theory. It's much easier than any other loss function on both counts. So it's the one that's usually used, but not because it's all that natural in any sense. Okay? If we're in the binary classification mode where the outcome is dichotomous, say -1, 1, then a very popular loss function is the one associated with logistic regression, which is this loss function. And whenever you do logistic regression and you score -1, 1, it'll look different if you score 0, 1. But if you score -1, 1, this is what it looks like. Some of you may have heard of support vector machines. This is the loss function used by a support vector machine. It's basically a piecewise linear or hockey stick approximation to the logistic regression function. And there are many, many more loss functions in the literature. In fact, any log likelihood corresponding to any probability model that you have will have an associated loss function. Once we have chosen a loss function, whichever one we want to use, or whichever one the software that we're applying insists that we use, we define the quality of the predicting function, or more precisely, the lack of quality of the predicting function by what's called the prediction risk, which is the average loss over future predictions. In statistics speak, it's expected value over the joint distribution of all of the variables of the loss when you predict y with the predicting function. Our predicting function has parameters a, so this risk is ultimately a function of the joint values of the parameters. So this is just the average loss of future prediction. That's the lack of quality that we want to make small. Once we've chosen our loss function, that we want to make small. Now, a natural thing would be, all right, let's make it as small as possible. Let's choose the parameters that minimize this prediction risk, this average loss, and just use those, because by our definition, they're the best you can do. The problem is that we don't know the prediction risk. We know the loss function. We know our predicting function. The thing we don't know is the joint distribution of the predictor variables. That's not known. So we don't know what the prediction risk is. If we can't compute the prediction risk, we obviously cannot find its minimum and get the optimal parameters, but we assume that they exist. There is an optimal set of parameters. It's just that if we knew the prediction risk, we could get them. So what can we do? Well, if you're a statistician, you say you take data. Namely, we assume we have a data set of previously solved cases where not only the joint values of the predictor variables have been measured, but also the corresponding outcome is known as well. These are previously solved cases. And we assume that this is a random sample drawn from the joint distribution for future predictions. That's our assumption. It's not always true. We hope it's probably never really true, but we hope it's a good approximation. So this is our what we call the training data set. It's a random sample that we presume is drawn from the same joint distribution as the X's and Y's in the future will be drawn from that we want to predict. Of course, in the future, we'll only know the X's and won't know Y. Okay? So then the natural thing to do, once we have this random sample drawn from the population, is to make an estimate of the prediction risk. We don't know it, but we can estimate it. And what do? Well, what's the natural estimate for a population mean? The prediction risk is a population mean. Well, it's the sample average. If you have a sample from that population, we'll estimate it by the sample average. So this is what's called the empirical risk. It is just the average over the training data of the loss when you predict each outcome with our, in our case, with our linear model. And of course, we know the outcome because this is training data. These are the previously solved cases. And this is our linear model. We know the X's, of course, and so far. Any set of parameters, we can evaluate that and get the empirical risk, an estimate for the actual risk, an estimate for the population risk. Then what's the natural thing to do? Well, we will minimize that with respect to the parameters and get that result as an estimate for the optimal parameter values, which we would have if we had either an infinite amount of data here or equivalently the joint distribution of the variables. So that's the natural way to do it. That's the way we've done it in statistics for any number of years. And it often works very well. But sometimes it doesn't. And it doesn't work well unless the number of observations in your training data set, the sample size of your training data set, is large compared to the number of parameters that you would like, that you're estimating. If that's not the case, this doesn't work well. And the reason why it doesn't work well is variance. The sample average is an unbiased estimate of the population mean. So we get an unbiased estimate of the prediction risk here by taking the sample average of the losses. Okay, and this leads to an unbiased estimate of the actual parameters that we're trying to estimate. But of course, since the data is random, our empirical risk is random, it's unbiased, but it has variance. And that variance can get large. I mean, when you take the sample average has an estimate of the population mean, has variance. It's unbiased, but it has variance. Okay? So this has variance. All right? That's bad enough. But what's really bad is that variance is greatly enlarged by the minimization process. We're minimizing this. And in fact, if the number of parameters is larger than the number of observations, this totally breaks down. The variance goes to infinity. And as you're well aware, there are many applications these days when the number of parameters greatly exceeds the number of observations in our training sample. I mean, in biology is a classic example. There's other fields as well. Okay. So the problem is very high variance. And that's why it doesn't work very well. So what can we do? Well, we do what statisticians always do when the data yields answers we don't like. We change them. All right, and this is how we change them. It's called the method of regularization. Okay? Instead of just minimizing the prediction risk, the empirical risk, which was what we did wrong way, which is what we did here, we do the same thing, but under a constraint. We constrain the solution. We don't let the solution be anything that the data would like to return. The constraint takes the form of some function of the parameters, usually just the coefficients, less than or equal to some threshold value. The threshold value regulates the strength of the constraint. We choose this function of the parameters such that when joint values of the parameter, such that it becomes large for joint values of the parameters we don't like, and it's small for joint values of the parameters that we like. Okay? So this is the constraining function. Now, obviously, this introduces a bias because we are pulling the solution away from what the data wants to what this constraining function wants, namely smaller values. Okay? Now, if we let T be large, there is no constraint. In fact, if T is large, is larger than the value of this constraining function for the unconstrained problem, then there's no constraint. We'll have no bias, but we'll have maximal variance. If we set T equals to the threshold equal to zero, then the inequality constraint becomes an equality constraint. It's very strong, and especially if this constraining function has a unique minimum, it's so strong that the data will be ignored and it will return the minimum value of this constraining function. Just ignore the data. Well, this constraining function is deterministic. It's not random at all. And so there'll be no variance there because we'll always get the same answer, the minimum of this function. But there could be huge bias if the minimum of that function is nowhere near the actual true answer. Okay. So neither of these extremes are good, setting the threshold very small or letting it be very large. But the hope is that there's some moderate value, some value in between the extremes of zero and larger, so large that the constraint doesn't apply, that produces an acceptable bias variance trade-off. It gives a smaller error, smaller actual risk than either of these extremes. That's the hope. Now, a problem here, of course, is we have a constrained optimization. Constrained optimizations can be easy or hard, but they're always kind of messy. And we would prefer to do an unconstrained optimization. And it turns out you can do that in the so-called Lagrangian formulation of the problem. And here is a different problem, but yields the same set of solutions. What we do is, we minimize this empirical risk, plus lambda times the constraining function. In this context, the constraining function is almost always called a penalty. And that's what I'll pretty much call it from now on, a penalty. Okay? So here, this parameter lambda controls the strength of the penalty, or the strength of the constraint. And it turns out that as lambda goes between 0 and infinity, the solutions to this problem map one-to-one to the solutions for the constraint problem for different values of t. When t is small, lambda is large, and vice versa. And you may have noticed the typo here. These inequalities should obviously be going the other way. Lambda can't be greater than or equal to infinity and then be less than or equal to zero. Okay. So as lambda goes from zero to infinity, the solutions traced out in this problem are exactly the same as in the constraint problem for the different levels. And there's a one-to-one correspondence between this parameter lambda and that parameter t. The beauty of this approach is it's totally an unconstrained optimization. And we can get the same set of solutions. An important point here, and one that should be kept in mind, is that for a given loss function, given data set, and a given penalty, the solution depends only on the parameter lambda. So that as lambda ranges from 0 to infinity, the solutions to this problem trace out a one-dimensional path in the n plus one-dimensional space of all possible solutions. There are n plus one parameters, n coefficients and one intercept. All joint values lie in a Cartesian space of dimension n plus one, which it can be quite high when the number of variables is in the thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands, but even 10 can be thought of as large. Okay. And what we're going to be doing is only examining solutions on a one-dimensional path. So if there were three parameters, and so this room were the parameter space, okay, we would be starting somewhere, lambda equals, say, infinity, and then let lambda get smaller and smaller and trace out a path. So we're examining a small fraction of all potential solutions with this approach. Okay. Now, the first problem here we have is that a path of solutions doesn't do us any good. What we need is a solution. Or put another way, we got to know what value of lambda to best use. And that's the job of what's called model selection. How do you choose this parameter, lambda? Well, we know what value we would like to use. That is the value that minimizes the risk, the actual, not the empirical, but the actual true prediction risk. But we don't know the actual true prediction risk. So, what can we do? Well, what's done in model selection is one derives a model selection criterion, I've called it R twiddle here, that can serve as a surrogate for the real prediction risk that can be computed from the data. And then we find the point on the path that minimizes the surrogate for the prediction risk. And that's our selected model. Now, this, the surrogate that you derive to do this will depend, of course, on what loss function you're using and what penalty you're using. And you've heard of various information criteria, BIC, AIC, minimum description length. There's a fair number, and they can be derived for usually squared error loss and either no penalty or some penalties. Okay. A technique that will work with any loss criterion and any penalty is cross-validation. That is, you divide the sample into a learning sample and then a test sample. You build the path on the learning sample and find the point that best predicts the left-out test sample. And you can do that repeatedly. You can put the test sample back, take out another, do that repeatedly, and average the results. That'll work with any loss and any penalty. Now, model selection, of course, is very important. There's been lots of books and a gazillion papers written about it. It's crucial to this exercise. But something that is at least equally crucial and is the topic of this talk is penalty selection. What penalty should you use? Okay, well, we know that the true optimal solution, which I've called A star, is a point in the space of all possible joint values of the parameters. It's some point to here, if we had three parameters, some point in this room is the best value. We're going to construct a one-dimensional path through the space, okay? And what we would like is we would choose a penalty that constructs a path that comes close to the truth. I mean, if it never comes close to the truth, if the closest point of the path to the true optimal coefficient vector is large, even with perfect model selection to find the closest point on the path, you're not going to do very well. You have to choose a penalty that builds a path that winds its way close to the truth. Now, keep in mind that these paths are random. They're constructed from the data, and the data is random. So depending upon what sample you happen to draw from the population, you might get a path that goes here the next time, another sample of the same size. But on average, you'd like them to come close to the truth. Okay? So you want to choose a penalty function based on whatever it is you think you know about the true optimal coefficient vector. Now, one of the things that we sometimes think we know, or a property of the optimal coefficient vector that we think we know, is sparsity, which has become a real buzzword in statistics now for the last few years. The basic idea here is that even though we may have measured or observed a very large number of predictor variables, only a very, very small fraction of them are actually driving the prediction. The other variables we didn't even have to measure. Unfortunately, we didn't know which ones. If we knew which ones were influential and which ones weren't, we'd throw away the non-influential ones, do our regression on the influential ones, and we'd be done. But we don't know which are the influential ones, but we think there aren't too many of them. Okay, here I've made a definition of sparsity of a coefficient vector. It's basically the number of coefficients that are small, say, compared to the largest coefficient. And the usual definition is the number that are zero, but I don't think in real life we ever have exactly zero-valued coefficients. In Monte Carlo trials, we can make up problems that have them that way, but I don't think in practice there are many that are exactly zero, but there can be a large number that are very, very small. Okay. And our assumption is that if our estimate Or the true, that's a good point. I don't think I've turned off mine either. Somebody might call me from California. Okay, thank you. The assumption is that if our estimate for the optimal is close to the true optimal coefficient vector, then it'll have similar sparsity. Its sparsity will be similar to the sparsity of the true coefficient vector. That's our assumption when we use methods to try to return sparse solutions. So we want to choose a penalty such that the sparsity of our estimates along the path, or at least those parts of the path that are good, namely close to the optimal solution, is similar to the sparsity of the true optimal coefficient vector. What if we don't know what the sparsity of the true coefficient vector is? Well, one way we can approach that is to define a family of penalties. Here I've indexed the penalty by a parameter gamma. And this parameter gamma regulates the sparsity. In other words, there are different penalties indexed by gamma, and some of those penalties produce very sparse solutions, some produce moderately sparse solutions, others produce dense solutions, and the whole family of penalties bridges sparse to dense solutions. And then we will use our model selection criterion, like cross-validation, or if you have another one, to jointly estimate not only the path point, but what penalty out of that family to choose. And this we proposed back in 93, called it bridge regression in honor of ridge regression, and the fact that it bridges sparse to dense solutions. We proposed it, but gave no hint as how you might actually be able to do it in practice. And so in the last few years, techniques have developed that allow you to actually do this in practice, and I'll show you some results. Okay. So your next question might be, are there families of penalties that have this property? And of course the answer is yes, otherwise the talk would end now. The most popular is, I call at least, the power family. Okay. And the penalties in this family all take the form, the sum of the absolute values of the coefficients each raised to the gamma power. Okay, so clearly gamma indexes the penalty. You have a different function of the coefficients for each value of gamma. Now this family is popular because, at least with squared error loss, it leads to the three most popular regularized regression methods that we have in statistics. When gamma equals 2, so this is the sum of the squares of the coefficients, this is, of course, ridge regression. Been around since 1970, although didn't become popular until maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Okay. When gamma equals 1, so the penalty is the sum of the absolute values of the coefficients, this is known as the lasso. It produces moderately sparse distributions. It was invented by my colleague, Rob Tipsurani, but for many years was your colleague here at Toronto. In fact, he was here at Toronto when he invented the lasso. Okay, and its popularity has been gaining wildly in the last 10 years or so. In fact, some journalists have said they will not publish any more papers on the lasso. There's been so many, and so many are submitted. I don't know if that's apocryphal or true, but it's become very, very popular. Okay, and that's because it is, even though it only produces moderately sparse solutions, it produces the sparsest solutions for the convex members of this family. When gamma is greater than or equal to 1, this is a convex function of its arguments. When gamma is less than 1, it's a non-convex function. Okay, convex functions are nice because, among other things, they have unique minima. The empirical risk, or the loss function, is usually convex, which means the risk is convex. And so if the penalty is convex, then you have a convex optimization problem to solve. If the penalty isn't convex, then you have a non-convex optimization to solve. And that's generally much, much harder. Anyway, continue with the story. Probably for years, the most popular method, regularized method, when you had too many variables, is equivalent to setting gamma equals to 0. That leads to subset selection. In fact, it leads to all subset selection, which for bigger problems we approximate with forward stepwise regression. So these three values, gamma equals zero produces the sparsest solutions, and that gives us all subset selection. Gamma equals one is the lasso, it produces moderately sparse solutions, and ridge regression, which is gamma equals two, produces the densest, very dense. I mean, all parameters are non-zero at every point on the path with ridge regression. Okay? And as I said, an important point in terms of implementation is that when gamma is greater than or equal to 1, this is convex, leading to convex programming to get the solutions. If gamma is less than 1, then you have a non-convex penalty, which means your whole criterion, empirical risk plus penalty, can be non-convex, and that's much, much harder. So there's not been nearly as much work with non-convex penalties. Now, the power family is not the only family that bridges subset selection, goes through the lasso, and then goes to ridge regression. Another one that I like better, has nicer properties from both computational as well as statistical, was proposed by Zoe and Hasty a few years ago. They called it the elastic net penalty. And their argument was, if you want a penalty in between the lasso and ridge, why not make the penalty a mixture of the two and then just adjust the mixture? And that's what this is. Beta adjusts the mixture. When beta equals 1, you have the lasso penalty. When beta equals 2, you have the ridge penalty, and for values of beta in between, you have penalties that produce solutions with properties in between the two. Somewhat similar, but not exactly similar, not exactly the same as the power family. The problem with this is that this penalty is always convex. A natural extension to the non-convex realm is this logarithmic penalty. This penalty has the property that when beta approaches zero, this penalty produces solutions that approach the subset selection penalty, the very sparsest. And when this, when beta approaches one, this penalty approaches the lasso penalty, thereby producing solutions close to the lasso. Now, if you combine this penalty, non-convex penalty, with the convex penalty, you have another then family that goes from subset selection through the lasso to ridge regression, another family that bridges very sparse to very dense solutions. Okay, so that's an introduction to penalties. So here is sort of a summary of bridge regression. Okay, we basically have to repeatedly solve this optimization problem. This is the empirical risk, the average of the loss over the data, which is a function of our parameters, plus lambda times a penalty. We have to solve this for a set of penalties in that span our family of penalties for various values of beta, and for each one of those betas, we have to solve it for a number of lambda values along its path. Okay. Once we've done that, we use our model selection criteria to jointly pick the best beta and the best lambda, and that will be our solution. Okay. And the big challenge here, I mean, intellectually, this doesn't seem too hard. The big challenge is computational, a fast enough algorithm for repeatedly solving this problem. Depending on your loss function, and thus your risk, and your penalty, solving this problem just once might be challenging. But we've got to solve it a lot more than once. Suppose we choose 10 penalties in our family. We choose 100 path points along the path. And we're doing 10-fold cross-validation to try and estimate which one. So therefore, we've got 10 penalties times 100, 1,000, 10,000. We'll have to solve this optimization problem 10,000 times. And that's a big challenge, especially if the penalty isn't convex, it's non-convex, in which case that's really a daunting challenge. So the intellectual content here, which I will not talk about because I was told this was supposed to be a general talk and not get into too much of the fine details, I'll give you a reference to the paper where I describe a very simple algorithm that allows you to do this. Okay? I call it GPS, for Generalized Path Seeking Algorithm. And I will just show you the results of using it here. and to try to answer the question, does it do us any good? Okay, so first I want to do an example just to kind of show what these solutions look like. This is an actual data set. It's the South African heart transplant data. It's used in our book. And this, the outcome variable is dichotomous, either success or failure of the operation. The predictor variables are various quantities that relate to the health of the patient. And so since the output is dichotomous, we'll do logistic regression, which means we'll be using this loss function. There are 9 predictor variables, thus 10 parameters and 462 observations. Okay, so what I've plotted here is the paths. Let me explain. Okay, what I've plotted for each of the 9 coefficients is their value as a function of lambda, starting at lambda equals infinity going to lambda equals 0. Okay? And I've done that for 4 penalties in the elastic net family. One with parameter 1.9, which means it's 90% ridge and 10% lasso. Here is 50-50 ridge and lasso. Here is 75% lasso, 25% ridge, and this is no ridge at all, just the lasso. And what I plotted here, so as when lambda equals zero, when lambda equals infinity, the solution is all coefficients equal to zero, because when lambda equals infinity, the empirical risk, the data is being ignored. We're only considering the penalty, and it's minimized when all the coefficients are equal to zero. Okay, as what I plotted down here is not actual value of lambda. This is the fraction of explained deviance, which is monotonic. As lambda gets smaller, the fraction of explained deviance on the training data gets larger and larger monotonically. So it goes from 0 to 0.2 as lambda goes from infinity down to 0. Now, a couple of things to notice here. First of all, with this penalty, all of these penalties, the variables enter sequentially. That's a nice thing about the elastic net family. For all members except ridge, which is the extreme, the variables always enter sequentially. Okay? Notice that when we have 90% ridge, 10% lasso, the solutions are very dense. At about halfway down here at 0.1, all but 2 of the variables are non-zero. Now, when we move down the family to try and get sparser solutions, we do. By 0.1, we have 5 only 5 that are not zero. At 1.25, notice that as we go down the chain, the variables are entering later and later. So here by this point, we've got almost all of them. By here and here at this point, we've got maybe half of them are non-zero. And the ones that are non-zero are bigger. Okay, so this is the convex part. And so dense solutions, sparser yet. This is the convex. All of these penalties here are convex. Now we can go down to the non-convex, and you see what happens is the trend continues. As we move down the penalty, I've repeated the last two here for comparison. Here is the penalty parameter at 0.5, and you see by 0.1 there's only 2 non-zero variables. Here there's only 1, and these variables tend to enter later and later, the more sparsity we're asking for by using the appropriate penalty. So we can control the sparseness of our solution by choosing the appropriate penalty indexed by that parameter, which I call beta. Okay. Now, a thing about this example is that it's illustrative, but basically this is a highly overconstrained problem. There are 10 parameters and 460 or so observations. And so regularization wasn't really needed. If we used cross-validation to tell us which point on the path to use, it would universally say very close to the end, very little regularization, because you have such an overdetermined. Same here, and same here. It would choose, notice, you probably didn't, but of course when lambda equals zero, the solutions are always the same, because lambda equals zero takes the penalty out of the problem. Okay. So I'll look at another problem, one where regularization is really needed. Okay, very underdetermined example. There are 10,000 predictor variables, which mean 10,001 parameters, and only 200 observations. And I should say I'm being generous. This is a simulated example because I want to look at accuracy comparisons. And the only way you can know accuracy is if you know what the truth is. And the only way you can know what the truth is if you played God and constructed the problem. So this is a simulated example with 10,000 predictor variables, 200 observations. I'm being a little generous here. Quite often in these genomic applications, 200 is a huge data set. Not 10,000 isn't huge. 100,000 is starting to get huge. But 200 is very generous quite often. And in any case, the X's were normally distributed with a correlation, a population correlation of 0.4 between every pair of variables, moderately correlated. The outcome was taken to be a linear combination of the predictor variables plus noise. The level of the noise was chosen to give a 3-to-1 signal-to-noise ratio, which again is being somewhat generous. Often signal-to-noises are not that high. Okay. For the optimal coefficients that were plugged in here to create the data, I chose out of the 10,000 coefficients 30 non-zero. 30 out of 10,000, so the true coefficient vector is very sparse. Okay, and I gave them a uniform distribution in absolute values, so that the largest coefficient was value 30, then the next one had absolute value 29, 28, 27, down to zero at coefficient 31. And to make the problem slightly more realistic, I gave half of the coefficients a positive sign and the other half a negative sign. Okay, so that's the problem. I can generate up a data set like this. I can run the various procedures with different penalties on it and look at the sparsity properties of the solutions in this case. And that's what I've done here. Okay. Here, on a logarithmic scale, is the number of non-coefficients at each point on the path. Okay, for different penalties. Here's forward stepwise regression. Here is beta equals zero, producing the sparse solutions, which is almost the same. Here's beta equals one, which is the lasso, and here is the elastic net with beta, I think, equal to 1.9. Okay. Now here again, I've labeled the x-axis not with the value of lambda, which is not terribly intuitive, but the r-squared on the training data, which of course is always zero when lambda equals infinity because all coefficients are zero. But, and of course, is one at the end because this is an undetermined problem, so you're able to perfectly fit the data if there's no regularization because you only have 200 observations and 10,000 parameters to fit it with. Okay, so it goes to one. So here is the solution, sparsest solutions by stepwise regression. And here you see, for example, at that point on the path where 80%, that explains 80% of the variance on the training data, typically has around 10. Non-zero coefficients. The lasso up here has over 100 to explain the same amount of variance of the training data, and the elastic net, which is 90% ridge, is close to 400 non-zero. Here it's again 5. When you're explaining 40% of the variance of the training data, it's 5 for the sparsest. And then as you change the value of the penalty parameter to get denser and denser solutions, you eventually get up to around 20 for the lasso and maybe over 100. The thing to notice here is that these curves are nested, which means that at every point on the path, when you go take the penalty parameter from 0 to 2, at every point on the path you get a denser solution, the higher that value goes. That's what this illustrates. So you can very tightly control the sparsity of your solutions along the path by penalty choice. So the next question is, okay, that's fun, maybe interesting, but does it do us any good in getting more accurate answers? And the answer to that question is, as it always is in statistics, yes, sometimes. Okay, that I already said. So what I want to do now is I want to look at the performance of different penalties on this data set, but not just this one data set, but on 50 random training samples drawn from this prescription. So remember, there are 10,000 variables, 200 observations. I generated not one, but 50 data sets. Same population, same joint distribution, but 50 different random samples. One would like to see how stable is the solution under different random samples from the same population. Of course, in your data set, you've only got one random sample from the population, but our sort of notion of variance of solutions is how does the solution change, or how does the quality change when you get different random samples. So I generated 50 data sets, and what we're going to look at is the distribution of the prediction risk at the optimal path point. I can pick the optimal path point because I know it. I'm going to look at the prediction risk for different penalties. Okay? And that is done here, upper left-hand corner, like that there. Okay? So here's what happened. Here is forward stepwise regression. Here is the procedure that you can read about, but I didn't talk about with parameter zero. Here are various non-convex penalties with introducing sparse and density increasing as the value of this parameter increases. This is the lasso, and this is the elastic net, half lasso, half ridge. And several things to notice here. So smaller is better. This is a prediction risk. First thing to notice is that down here, those procedures producing the very sparsest solutions are highly unstable, in that sometimes they do rather very, very well. Sometimes they do very, very badly. And there's a huge spread in the accuracy that you get as you change the random sample from the same joint distribution. As you move up the scale of penalties, so you are less aggressively selecting variables, the solutions become more stable. Notice that forward stepwise regression and the lasso on average are performing about the same. On many data sets, the forward stepwise was much, much better than the lasso. On others, it was much, much worse, whereas the lasso was consistently mediocre. And so one lesson from this is if you have a data set, you run forward stepwise, you run the lasso, and you say, well, forward stepwise did better or the lasso did better. That might be true for that one data set, but it's not generically true for that situation, because if you'd have gotten another data set from the same joint distribution, you might have gotten an entirely different result. Basically, what happens with the very highly sparse, aggressively variable selecting penalties is when they select and get it right, they win big. When they select and get it wrong, they lose big, and there's not a lot in between. Whereas those that admit more non-zero variables produce denser solutions, kind of hedge their bets. They'll put many more in at different strengths. That increases the stability, but not necessarily the average accuracy. We also see here that there is a best penalty. It's probably that one in terms of both expected and variation. And it's the penalty associated with the value of that parameter being 0.2, which is a sparse, non-convex penalty, but not the sparsest. Here I've plotted for this situation the number of non-zero variables at the optimal path point for each of those same. Okay? We see that forward stepwise regression typically has about 10 non-zero coefficients at its optimal solution, 10 out of the 10,000. And as we relax the penalty and less aggressively select, the number of variables at the optimal solution steadily increases, so that by the time you get to the elastic net, it's around 150. That's still pretty sparse. Remember, there's 10,000 total coefficients. It's putting in, at its best solution has 150 non-zero, whereas these guys, their best solution has 10 to 12. Here is the same plot as this one, but for a different situation. In this situation, instead of a correlation of 0.4 between all pairs of variables in the population, the correlation is 0 between all variables, pairs of variables in the population. That doesn't mean the data. I mean, some of the correlations can get rather large in the data, even if the population is 0, because, you know, you've only got 200 observations and you've got a whole lot of pairs of variables, and some of them can creep up, but at least it's 0. In the population. And here we see something similar to here. Everyone gets better. The penalties that induce the sparsest solutions improve the most. And we see here then around 0.1 tends to be roughly the best penalty here. Here is the bizarre case. In this case, it's exactly the same as this. There's a correlation of 0.4 between all pairs of variables. The problem set up, the population set up, is exactly the same except for one fact. If you recall, in the problem, as I set it up before, half the coefficients had positive sign, the other half had negative sign. I thought that was making the problem more realistic. Maybe it is. So I decided what would happen if I gave them all the same sign. Same correlational structure, everything, same signal to noise, same generation of x's. The only difference is that now all of the same absolute values of the coefficients, ranging from 30 to 1, but they all have the same sign instead of different sign. And notice that everything changes. Those penalties that were the best here and here are now by far the worst. And those that were the worst here and here are now by far the best. Also, everything is outrageously more stable for all of them. I mean, this curve here is kind of the inverse of that curve. I mean, it's kind of surprising. The best procedure here is this elastic net. It's half ridge, half lasso. It's typically putting in 150 non-zero variables at its optimal solution when the truth is 30. But yet, it's doing much better than procedures that are putting in the right number of non-zero variables. They're just not getting them right. And so this was a puzzle, and I'm embarrassed to say how long it took me to figure it out. But what was going on here? And it's a variance concern. One of the reasons why it's surprising is the penalty only depends on the absolute values of the coefficients. The signs don't enter at all. Yet the quality of the solutions changes dramatically when the signs are different for the same absolute values. And that is a real surprise that I didn't anticipate, and I don't think anyone else would have either. How am I doing on time? 5 minutes. All right. So, all right, 5 minutes, maybe I can do it. The last part may blur. All right, so what can we conclude from this very simple simulation study? First of all, that when the number of parameters you're trying to estimate, number of coefficients, is much, much greater or even approximately equal to the number of observations in your training sample, regularization is essential. The best penalty to choose depends upon several things. It depends upon, as was our original motivation, the sparsity of the true optimal coefficient vector. The big surprise is it also depends on their signs. And it depends on the joint distribution of the predictor variables as well. And so even if you think you know the sparsity of the true coefficient vector, you may not know their signs and you may not know the details of the X distribution. So you're going to need to do bridge regression. You're going to have to do this procedure of trying out a number of penalties, jointly solving for the penalty and the path point. And although I only illustrated this here for squared error loss, in the paper you'll see the results for logistic regression, and they're pretty much the same. Okay, I'll try and... Okay, this is the last point, last two transparencies. One technique that is often used when you have this problem of way too many variables is you first try to select the variables with some variable selection procedure, decide which and how many to select, and then do an ordinary regression on the selected variables. Now, one thing you can do is you can use these regularized regression procedures in that mode, namely just select the variables and then use some other regression procedures such as ordinary unconstrained regression, linear least squares, or ordinary linear regression, logistic regression, on the selected variables. So how would you do that? You would go along the path that was for any particular penalty. The lasso is often used for this. At every point, you identify the non-zero variables. You get the value of the coefficients for the non-zero variables by doing an unconstrained ordinary regression, and then set the others to zero, so that the path procedure is only telling you which ones are zero or not, and then you're using ordinary regression to get the values of the one that it says are not zero. And you can do that for any of these procedures, not just the lasso. So here I did that. Same thing, same set of penalties, same everything. The red dashed lines are the medians of what we got here. So we can compare and see if that works better. Just use these procedures to select the variables and then do an ordinary regression. And you do that at each path point. And then pick the best path point again by cross-validation. Okay, so that's what I did here. And here are the situations. On this situation, we see that definitely improves things. These are the old medians when we use the procedures straight. Here's what happens when we use them as selectors to as a pre-process to an ordinary linear regression. Of course, for forward stepwise, the result is the same. Here is the number of variables that enter with this procedure, and we see in doing that, things that produce denser solutions before get much better. The lasso used just as a variable selector at the best path point typically has about 20 to 30 non-zero coefficients, where when it was used straight, it had 125 or so. And the same thing here. We see that when the correlation is zero in the population, again, especially for the techniques that produce very dense solutions, what this is basically saying is they're not doing a terrible job in selecting the variables. They're doing a bad job in estimating what the values of the non-zero coefficients should be. And that has been long suspected, and that's what motivated this approach. In fact, there's a whole slew of papers and theorems that say, under certain circumstances, using the lasso will enter the variables in the same order as does all subsets regression, which is the gold standard in many of those things. Okay, but what's required is that there be very little correlation amongst the predictor variables, and those are the sample correlations, not the population correlation. If all the variables were uncorrelated in the training sample, which of course cannot happen if you have more parameters than observations, but if they were, then all of these procedures would enter the variables in exactly the same sequence. The only reasons why they'll enter them differently, while you get different variables non-zero, has to do with the correlations amongst the variables. Basically, if you ask for if you have two variables that are very highly correlated, okay, and so the question is, they're really surrogates of each other. The question is, when you go to enter, which one do you enter, or do you enter both? Dense solutions like Ridge will enter both at half the strength. So put them in each at half the strength to get them both in. At the other extreme, the sparsest procedures will choose one of them and ignore the other one. That's basically what's going on. Okay. But the interesting thing here is that all of these methods here and here are using the same procedure to estimate the values of the non-zero coefficients. They only differ on which ones they say are not zero. And what you see is that these highly non-convex penalties are doing a much better job at selection, not just at estimating the values of the non-zero coefficients, but deciding which ones are non-zero. And of course, our anomalous situation, which I shouldn't say is anomalous, it may happen more often than not that all the coefficients are the same sign. Actually, the same sign is not quite right. The relative signs of the coefficients, if they're the same as the sign of the correlation between them, namely, if the correlation is negative and the relative signs are negative, that's a positive concordance and positive-positive. Here, since the correlations are all positive and now the coefficients are all positive, then you see the effect. And here, of course, it's contrary. Here, using it as a selector actually makes things worse. So the answer is you don't want to use that selection strategy when dense solutions are appropriate. You only want to use it when sparse solutions are appropriate. How do you know which is appropriate? You do them both, look at the cross-validated error, and see which one seems to be working better. Okay, so conclusions from that is that when a sparse non-convex penalty is best, it's because it's doing better variable selection as well as shrinkage, estimating the value of the coefficients. The best direct methods are the best selectors, and again, the results are the same as in the paper for logistic regression. Here's some bibliography. If you want the transparencies of this talk, you can get it there. The whole paper, including the actual algorithm that gets all those solutions so fast, is in this paper, and then there's an R interface that you can download from my website if you want to try it out. And I thank you for your attention.